Well, as promised, and as always, David Shapiro is first up. You've been travelling around the world, Dave?
I have. I was in Australia over December.
Those bushfires.
Yeah. Alec, it's quite tragic to see what's happening there, and it's becoming a political battle. No one's quite sure what's caused them. There's a lot of debate. I'm not going to get in between it, but I think all that I can conclude is that things are not going to be the same. And I think people are going to be a lot more careful about the environment, the way they act, the way they, you know, conduct their lives, and hopefully a lot more precaution, because I think the tragedy is the area that has been destroyed. And I think the thing that gets to us, you know, besides homes, and there have been personal lives, firefighters, volunteers, is the huge amount of animal life that has gone. I think a third of the population of koala bears, you know, burned, suffocated, and so on. So it's a tragedy of monumental proportions.
It is indeed. On to issues closer to home. Well, I suppose not so close to home, because NICEPERS's subsidiary Process has been at it in the UK, trying to buy Just Eat. They went in at around 700p a share, pushed it up to 800p a share, but they've admitted defeat. Now, David, is this a good thing? It tends to, the performance of the share price tends to say that just as well they lost.
That's terrible. I think he got a bit of a beating, and for a bit I felt like defeated, you know, when you see his whole strategy backfired onto him. Take a lot, or Just Eats was taken out by Take a Lot. What's it take? Not Take a Lot. Take Away. But there are plenty of other opportunities, I think, in that area. Alec, the one thing is that if you're going to go into an area, I think you've got to be dominant. And, it's got to be something of large proportion and something that's going to make a difference to Process. But the market seems to have reacted almost celebratory and pushing the share price up and saying, well, we missed that one. But I think in the press he's come off, or in the media, in the international media, he's come off as having been comprehensively beaten. And I don't know how that's going to affect his ego in any way. But, I mean, as a shareholder, I don't, you know, we take these things in our stride. This is going to happen. You're going to go for some companies. You're going to miss a few, as long as you don't overpay and become silly and allow your ego to take over in terms of what you're going to pay. But there's still plenty of opportunity in the IT space for Van Dyk to, you know, to look at. So this is by no means over.
Yeah, Bob van Dijk, the chief executive of Process, and he used to be the chief executive of NICEPERS as well, making this run at a UK company called Just Eat. It was all over the headlines internationally here in South Africa. It didn't get quite as much coverage, but I suppose that's to be expected. We don't buy our takeaways in the evening from Just Eat, but it's a huge company, David. It would have been a very, very good deal for NICEPERS at the right price. Sorry, for Process, now we must call
Process,
it at the right price. But
it will.
You know, I remember when Marcus Joester was on his takeover spree. I know it's a bit of a swear word in South Africa now, and for pretty good reason when you talk about Marcus Joester. But the market liked the fact when he walked away, or seemed to walk away, from a couple of deals. Argos was one of them, for instance. So isn't this just a reflection that the market sometimes doesn't like the uncertainty of big acquisitions?
I think so, and I think particularly this was a hostile battle, or I think Bob van Dijk was making it into a hostile battle. So I think that just unsettled shareholders. And remember, you're not only talking to local shareholders, you know, where he might be a hero, or where NICEPERS might be a hero company. I think this is in the international scene where you've got a lot more choices to make. So I think people there are a lot more discerning about valuations. So I think from that point of view, they feel comfortable in his strategy. But Alec, you know, there's plenty of opportunity. There's plenty of time for him. He doesn't have to rush things. He can wait for the right, for the right company to come up. And I think there's India. You know, there's India. There's Brazil. There's so many other areas in which he can participate. It's a big market, and I think all you have to do is to go into a big city today and to see the number of people riding around on bikes, either you know, push what we call pedal bikes,
buzz
or
bikes.
Alternatively
buzz bikes.
Yeah, buzz bikes, or even literally pedal bikes, delivering food. So I think it's still a massive area. And he's identified it as the area that he wants to get into.
Yeah, well, they're in it, and they just want to get – they want to be world dominant, and don't we all? David, somebody who is world dominant, who's actually got embroiled in quite a scrap here in South Africa, is a guy called Rodney Sacks.
Yes, I know.
You know Rodney at all?
Sure. Greenside Boys.
Oh my word!
Victory Park Boys.
Now tell us a story. Tell us the story of Rodney Sacks, the Greenside Boy.
I know this is Monster, the drink.
Yes.
But Rodney was with Les. I knew his brother Les better, who owned an art gallery here called Les Art, which was in Rosebank. But the Sacks boys came from Victory. They went to King David in Victory Park. Rodney was at either Edward Nathan or Worksman's. I forget. You know, was he Worksman?
He was
a litigant. He was known as a hard-ass litigant lawyer. You know, if ever you had a tough case, you called Rodney in. So that was his reputation. And that's not necessarily bad. I think there are a couple of chaps around like that at the moment. You know, it happens in life. You get these cases. But, he was, I think, respected. I'm not saying not respected, but he was a litigant lawyer. And I know he went to L.A., and his brother's still there, Les. I think Les has still got an art gallery in there.
They're in Joburg. Yeah.
And I know that they made a lot of money out of Monster, which is the what do you call it?
Energy drinks.
Energy drinks. So that's Rodney. Yeah, but that's I can't contribute more than that, knowing that. I just remember them as younger people.
Well, let me tell you a little story on Rodney Sacks as well. So he goes to – he was, by the way, the youngest ever partner at Worksman's. He was there for 20 years. Then he goes to the U.S. and together with Hilton Schlossberg – I don't know if you remember Hilton.
Yeah.
You can tell us a bit about him in a moment. They buy a small beverage company for $12.5 million. They've turned it now into – a huge company called Monster, which is $30 billion market cap, and it has been the best performer in the world of all shares you could have bought on the 1st of January 2000. So for the current decade, for the current century, in 20 years in, it's the best performer. The numbers are quite staggering. If you'd put $100 into Monster on the 1st of January 2000. It would today be worth $65,000. Yeah. So these Greenside boys are pretty nifty, David.
Yeah, well, Joffy came from Greenside, but these Joffy was from Greenside. I'm trying to think who else came from Greenside. But look, it is. It's a phenomenal story. I don't know much. I've just seen Monster. It's one of these real – you got to really be down to go and have one of these drinks, you know. It's
like a Red Bull. Do you prefer Red Bull?
Yeah. No, I'm a Red Bull. Yeah, but I can't remember Hilton that well.
Hilton Schlossberg. Yeah. Even in my career, I do recall him. He was quite a mover and shaker. And he went over there. He became the chief. He's the chief operating officer. And I think the one's the chairman, and the other one's the president.
Yeah,
they have funny titles in America. But the reason why Rodney Sacks is back in the news is because he has been a long-time director of Comair. And Comair is having an extraordinary time. He resigned off the board. Van der Hoeven, the chairman, resigned off the board. Lindsay Ralphs from Bidvest seems to be making a shaking up the place. And it all relates, it all goes back to some pretty poor governance that went on with an acquisition that they did of a company called Metico, which we'll be talking to Barbara Walsh of Metico in a little while. But, David, have you been following Comair? Or do you remember, maybe we go back a bit, when Brian Joffe first bought in for Bidvest years ago, there was a bit of a punch-up in the boardroom, and then things quietened down, and I think Joffe then left long after that.
Mm-hmm. Remember Gidon Novick?
That's right.
Resigned as well. I think he had a bit of a, I don't know what he wanted to do. I think the backdrop to that was that because Joffe, I think wanted to impose certain what the word be, and I might be talking out of turn, but I think Gidon probably felt that they weren't acting in the best interest of the company. They weren't what's the word? Is that some of the deals were they had interest in? You know, in other words, conflicts. Seeing deals done conflicts. Yeah, that's. I was trying to think of the, there were conflicts of interest in it, and I think that's why Gidon resigned. He wanted to be open-minded when they did deals. I think because wasn't Joffe involved, you know, he was involved in the airports company, and I think this is where the conflict might have been. But I don't know it well enough to really comment, but I think that was the backdrop to that.
But it's very
and Brian
messy.
Had bought what, Comair.
Very messy it was going messy. On at the moment. But now, with these changes in the boards, it's terribly messy.
Yeah.
What do you do in a case like that, David? Do you? They've got two of those Boeing Maxes on the on the runway,
which yeah, and which they can't fly at the moment.
Do you stay in the share?
I don't know. I haven't been in it for a long time. You know, it's been a very small company, and also the reason I didn't get into it is simply because of the petrol price and the swings in costs of running an airline. They've been so difficult. Although they should be in a very good position now with SAA in receivership or in business rescue, you know, Comair should be very well placed to actually benefit. And this is a company that I don't think has ever shown a loss at its entire life. It's been superbly run. But I mean, at this stage, yeah, there are issues. And remember, they've got the issues of trying to claim that money, you know, which has already gone into the share price. The billion award, that was made, which they might never get.
What happened there was that
I don't know where they're going to be in with regard to that.
Yeah, Competition Commission or Competition Tribunal awarded them R1 billion from South African Airways predatory pricing and anti-competitive practices. But now with South African Airways in, business rescue, that might not come through. But David, this share price was comfortably over £5.
Gotta look at it now.
Only a year ago, it's now sitting at 263. So it's virtually halved in that period. You've got shake up in the boardroom. Yep. They've lost Rodney Sachs, Mr. Monster, the guy who went and created Monster, who stayed on the board. He's resigned, possibly in disgust, and saying, "Look, he doesn't want to be involved with this little peanut company. You know, relative to his, if it isn't going to be performing properly." What do you do? It's got a market cap of just over R1.2 billion.
And look, I think the history supports the share price at these levels. I think that's they're still an operating company, and I think they're still a profitable operating company. I think that Lindsay comes with a very high reputation. He's not a chap, you know, you can see the effects that he's having on some of the companies that Brian did buy, Adcock Ingrams and Comair, you know, when he was still at Bidvest. I don't think these fit into the Bidvest stable at the moment, but I think he comes in there having an investment in it and says, you know, as long as I'm invested, I'm going to make sure that it performs. So my money's on Lindsay at the moment, you know, and I think that the shakeups that come will be for the benefit. And I think this is a company that I say has performed very well. I think everything's in its favor at the moment. So maybe this is a time to pick up at 250, 260.
Okay, on to MTN. There's a company that's also been under the cosh, but some good news at last coming from Nigeria. A $2 billion demand from the Attorney General. Now, that's been dropped. So is it time to say, despite their issue now in Iran as well, where they're being accused of supporting the Taliban in American courts, is it time to say, at last, you should be investing in MTN again?
You know what I like about MTN, and what I like, and this is a theme that's going to dominate for the next decade, is the huge amount of data that consumers are going to use. So they've got that in their favor. Alec, what the challenge is how to make that profitable. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that demand for data over the next year, 10 years, is going to go up tenfold globally. The more cell phones that people have, the smarter the cell phones, the more entertainment, music, and everything that we use, the more demand for data. point is that you're in the MTN, Vodacom are in that position where they can benefit, and I include a lot of global companies. How are you going to make that work for you? So I think they're in the right area for what lies ahead. It's whether they can make this profitable, and whether they can keep their costs, and whether they can deliver data. I think they've got government against them at the moment. I think government's got to increase spectrum and support them. But I mean, they are in the right place. These are the right kind of companies that can benefit. So get all this mess out the way. Get your strategies right. Demand for your product is only going to increase.
And to close off with, Mondi, the fairly recently appointed chief executive, Peter Oswald, leaving after 3 years. He'll be leaving at the end of March. There's no successor that's been named. What's the thought on that one, David? What happens when somebody leaves under these conditions?
We're battling to understand this. You know, he was only there 3 years. Admittedly, he's a veteran of 22 years. We don't know what's behind his resignation. You know what happens? Sometimes you come from a CFO position, you know, come from a number two or three or four in charge, and suddenly you get to the top position. It's not that easy to run it. So I don't know what's pushed him out. You know, we never heard any stories. It's a tough industry. Costs are increasing. Demand is reducing. Demand for your products reducing. So it's not an easy area to be in, but this has been a very good performing company and it's been very well run. But we haven't got to the bottom of what's been behind the resignation. In the meantime, the market has gone negative on the resignation, looking for some reason that he got out or whether he was kicked out. But I mean, overall, it hasn't done much over the last few years, but it's still a very good company.
David Shapiro, as always, bringing us up to date on the latest movements in the markets. Thanks, Dave. Good talking with you. Well, we were talking about MTN just a moment ago, and somebody who's got some good news for MTN is Marius Hollenbach. He is with My Broadband, and you guys do a quarterly survey, Marius. This time around, MTN, I think they've been top for a while, so I can't say this time around. So it has been it seems to almost be a permanent fixture now at the top of the My Broadband survey. Just by way of background, though, you do this four times a year. What exactly do you check on?
Yes, as you rightly said, MTN has been on the top for a while. So some background on the research we do. We collect data from the mobile network operators through a few ways. And then we process all of the data to come up with a best mobile network for the country. So firstly, we've got an app that people can install on their smartphones. Using this app, people can run network tests on the smartphones that measures the download speed, upload speed, and latency of the mobile network operator they are using.
What's a latency?
Latency is essentially the time it takes for a message to get from your phone to the endpoint where you're pulling data from and then back. So. Okay. So that is usually measured in milliseconds. So if you, for example, visit a simple web page, there'll be a slight delay where your computer or your smartphone will try to connect over the network to the web page you're trying to access. So it's essentially the delay on how long that message takes to get to the resource you are looking for.
Good.
And then obviously the download speed and obvious upload speed is the rate at which data is then transferred. So users can install this app on their smartphone and test these three metrics to see for themselves what their mobile network operator is giving them. Along with this, we've got a specialized vehicle that we drive across the country. And this vehicle runs constant tests that also measure these three indicators. So we do thousands of kilometers doing tests all along the way. We take all of this data, the user data and the tests we do ourselves, and then process that into a score that we give each network operator. And this network score is a value that shows the relative performance of the network operators against each other with a maximum score of 10.
And MTN came out very close to 10 and well clear of Vodacom. Was that a surprise?
Yes. No, MTN has been doing very well. The in our previous quarter, in quarter three of 2019, they came out with a network score of 10 because their latency was slightly faster than Rain's at the time, which means they scored a perfect. They came out on top in all three metrics, but this time around, Rain edged them slightly in latency. So that just dropped their network score just below 10, but still excellent performance from MTN. They showed massive improvements on download speed. It was a really big jump. So well done for them. And this is obviously because of they've been investing so much in the network over this past few years, and they continually invest. And from what we can see, is just excellent performance.
So MTN has been investing in the network, or investing heavily, or more heavily, presumably, than Vodacom, and is now reaping, or its users are reaping the rewards. Has this translated into market share?
I can't give you a direct answer on that, but having the best network certainly does bode well for MTN. And if users out there are looking to maybe switch networks or sign up to a new contract, this is definitely something they will be looking at, because if you can afford it, you definitely want to be on the best network to ensure you've got the best performance. But that also doesn't mean that in the specific area you'll be using the network, you will always get the best performance. Even some of the smaller guys, Telkom and Cell C, do beat out the bigger guys in very specific areas. So if you're going to be making a decision on which network operator to use, there are a bunch of things you have to take into account. But nationally, across the board, MTN does outperform the other guys.
Now, Vodacom is very competitive. Surely they would be doing something to try and at least close that gap.
Yes. They have been trying, and it is a very big task to catch up. And just on that note, Vodacom has himself been performing very well. The quality of the network that Vodacom has is excellent. But catching up to MTN, they'll have to invest a lot, and they'll have to almost out-invest MTN for quite some time just to catch up to where MTN is at the moment. So it's a very difficult task, but I'm sure Vodacom will be trying their best to get on top.
But Maurice, are you seeing it? Are you seeing Vodacom cranking up their investment to try and do that, or are they happy with the status quo?
Well, I don't think they're happy with their status quo. I'm sure they are trying. And from our results, all across all the operators, we do see in specific sections and specific areas a big improvement. So it is a challenge. But another aspect that all the operators are fighting is the lack of spectrum. So as soon as they get the spectrum, they need to roll out new technologies or to provide a better service to customers, that will be a massive improvement that we'll see in the results. But at this stage, it's a fight with what they have, and I must say that the top two guys are performing really well.
That's interesting. So towards the end of this year, or certainly the second half of 2020, we've been promised by Stella Abrams Ndabeni, that the Minister of Communications, that they will have spectrum available, and we might see different results there. But for what we have at the moment, you mentioned Rain. I see they come in at number three on the list. It's still quite a long way behind MTN and Vodacom, though.
Yes. Out of the five operators, only MTN and Vodacom really have a national network. So they're the only two guys that can offer a service to essentially anyone in the country. Rain, Telkom, and Cell C, their footprint just so much smaller. So Rain, when they started out, did really well, and they've been keeping a good performance, but as soon as you start gaining more customers and you start have to serve them at the same quality, it becomes a challenge. So So it's going to be a very long ride for any of the smaller guys to ever catch up to MTN, Vodacom in terms of network size. So we've seen Telkom roaming, having a roaming agreement with Vodacom, so subscribers get that advantage, and also Cell C, they've been using M2N to some degree, but it's for the smaller guys, it's a challenge. They'll have to be smart in the way they approach their network rollout and their partnerships, because realistically it's tough for them to compete on a national network level.
Now, Marius, you are plugged into all of this. Most of us watch from the sidelines and read what we can to try and understand how who's telling the truth and what's really marketing. But Rain is talking a good game on 5G, that 5G is going to be its focus area, its sweet spot. Where is all of that? How much of that do we take seriously, given that they come so poorly or so far behind both Vodacom and MTN in your survey?
So 5G, I think, is a game changer. It's important to just make a difference, or to mention a difference between the data we collect. We currently focus on mobile networks. So Rain has only launched their 5G as a fixed line alternative. So that means your router stays in your house; you can't move it around. And I've been using their services, and I must say I'm astonished. The speeds I get and the quality of the network is just phenomenal at this stage. So if they can translate that into a mobile service, it's gonna be huge for them. And the same for the other guys, Vodacom and MTN. But it's a challenge, as we mentioned, the spectrum issue, and the technology the way 5G works is quite challenging in terms of the distance a tower can cover, or the radius it can cover around it. So your expenditure on building a 5G network is so much more than building a LTE network, for example. So it's 5G is, I think, gonna be a big differentiator, but I think we're still quite a while off before we buy smartphones in a store that effectively run on a full 5G network. It's just such a challenge to build those networks and to get the spectrum from government.
So if we are looking at people who've got fiber in their homes, then it sounds to me like the best call is going to be Rain if they're in your area. I suppose that's another big thing, because clearly they don't cover the whole country.
Yes. It is a very good option, and that's exactly the reason I've been using them for a bit. I've tried a few options, and it is a great service. And we'll have to wait and see what the product, the 5G product offering, looks like in future, because they're the first guys offering it really, and it's on an uncapped basis, competing directly with the fiber offerings we have available. But we will have to see if that's a long-term solution or offering that they can provide. If it is, it would be absolutely fantastic. But these fiber networks and all the other fixed line solutions are quite mature, and they've come a long way. So there's a lot of competition, and the offerings are really fine-tuned. So we'll see how that works out for Rain. But it's a great solution for the moment.
So just to close off with, what download and upload speeds are you getting with that 5G connection? So, Rain?
It does vary, but I never go. The speeds I'm getting are never under 200 megabits per second, which is extremely fast. And I think I'm on the lower tier of speeds. I've spoken to some people that get much higher speeds. But just to put or jumping back to the mobile network performances, we on our normal tests where we use smartphones that support only LTE, we also see speeds well over 100 megabits per second on both Vodacom and MTN. So that already shows how competitive these networks are and what good service they provide. Obviously, not everyone in the street is going to get these speeds, but it is achievable and it is out there, and just shows how hard these guys are working to give us a great service.
Well, it's a warm welcome to Barbara Walsh. Good to Happy New Year to you, Barbara. I hope 2020 is a better year for you than 2019. And I'm sure you know what I mean by that, given all the legislative issues that you had with Comair. Maybe just recap for us quickly. Metico is a company that you started with your partner, Danny. You got into a pretty unsavory relationship with Comair. What's happened there?
Okay, so I think where we left off the last time, we were just in the process of starting arbitration proceedings, which are now underway. We had the pre-arbitration meeting on the 14th of December, where the legal teams on both sides and our arbitrator were present. So the whole proceedings are underway now. And yeah, this is something we're committed to for the long term, Alec. However long it takes, we're in for it.
And the arbitration is about what?
So the arbitration, if I recap on what happened, in August 2018, Comair acquired our company, Metico. It's a leadership development consultancy, and the intention was that Metico would form a key pillar in the aviation and general academy that the Comair was busy developing. Very big vision for a world-class international academy. And leadership was a big part of that. It was a very exciting vision. We were working with Eric Fenter at the time, the then CEO of Comair. And it was such an honor to be a part of something like that. And we were very excited about the acquisition, about our role in it. Not very long after that, so we're looking at less than a year, there was a complete about turn along the way. Eric had resigned, so he too had been experiencing, as we understand it, his own challenges, and he resigned, and Comair did a complete about turn on the strategy for the academy and decided they no longer needed Metico. But instead of sitting down and talking to us about the revised strategy, you know, we work in leadership, we understand that strategies change, they issued us with a notice of breach, a very sudden meeting, our first meeting ever actually with Glenn Osmond, as it turned out, before he was even CEO, which he accused us of being in breach of the sale agreement. And later on, we were also served with a notice of a put notice, which effectively meant that they were reversing the transaction and wanting their purchase fee plus interest back. We don't agree that we were in breach, and we feel that a far better solution would have been to sit down and talk about this. We weren't given any opportunity to do so. And so we've had no option but to take the legal route. And that's what we've been doing. We spent a lot of time on this, and we've been very careful and very thorough in our approach, and we're ready.
Who owns Metico now?
Well, that's an interesting part of it. Metico was Comair. Comair decided they didn't want it anymore. At the moment, it's kind of betwixt and between. They took all their directors off the board, which just left us with the company to run. And we've had to do whatever's necessary to support the company and to put it in a position where we can start to rebuild it. If we hadn't have done that, we would have been neglectful of our directors' duties. So we've been supporting the company, we've been running it, we've been building it again. Who owns it? Well, I think that's going to be that's part of what will come out, I suppose, of the arbitration.
Did you ever deal with Rodney Sacks, one of the board members at Comair?
No, we didn't. Not directly. The only contact, to put it that way, that we had was when we emailed the whole board directly wanting to sit down and discuss this. And he obviously was one of the board members at the time, but not directly, and we had no direct contact with him.
Because the timing of all this is interesting. Just go back into Rodney Sacks for a moment. David Shapiro was telling us that he's a Greenside boy. He was a very hard-assed litigator when he worked for Worksmans for 20 years. He then went to the United States, where he's been super successful. He's basically the founder of Monster, which is a $30 billion U.S. Market cap company. But he remained on the board of Comair until recently. He's resigned. Mm. So has the long-serving chairman, Piet van Hoeven. resigned. Now, this is the timing is really interesting because Metico's story hits the media. We certainly have spoken about this a bit, and other media outlets have also been addressing it. Lindsay Ralphs, the chief executive of Bidvest, starts getting a lot more involved. We're having resignations off the board, long-standing members of the board at Comair. It looks like you've lit some kind of a firecracker within the Comair organization, or are there other reasons perhaps that might be causing these ructions?
Well, I think the ructions, if I read the media correctly and understand what has been written about it, are probably more to do with governance issues at Comair. Very long-standing board members. It wasn't only Sachs and Van Hoeven, but there was Martin Moritz as well. He's also one of the long-standings. Pete Welkemut was another one. So all of the long-standing members of the board have gone, and that's something that Lindsay Ralph said that he was going to do at the AGM. Is that directly related to us? I doubt it. I think that there were probably concerns on Bidvest's part and perhaps other shareholders as well before the AGM. I think potentially what we've done is just make those concerns more public.
Have you engaged with any of those people whose names you've mentioned?
No. Actually, if I just repeat something that Lindsay Ross was quoted as saying in one of the articles. And he said, we tried to engage with them, but we encountered a lot of resistance. So we exercised our rights and voted at the AGM. Well, we can say we had pretty much the same experience. We tried to engage with them, but we encountered a lot of resistance and actually got nowhere. And so it's I don't know whether that's a pattern or not, but it certainly was our experience as well.
I just want to understand that better. You tried to engage with Comair. Is Lindsay Ralph saying he tried to engage with the directors? Is this the issue that you're talking about? Or did they try and engage with you?
The directors didn't try and engage with us. No, I think Lindsay Ralph is talking about trying to engage with the long-standing directors.
All right. So you haven't met any of these people. You haven't had anything to do with them.
The only one that I've met personally of the people who have resigned is Derek Borer, and very briefly once Piet van Hoeven. I haven't met any of the others. So Danny Tuck with my partner met them at the AGM, but apart from that, no, we haven't had any direct contact with them.
You mentioned the AGM. What exactly was Danny hoping to achieve, and what was he asking them?
Well, Danny attended the AGM as a shareholder. So I think it's quite important to draw the distinction that that's something quite different to Metico. What Metico had experienced, or what we'd experienced in the story with Metico, was I think something that was just symptomatic of governance generally, as it was happening at Comair at the time. And yeah, that was just something we wanted to highlight and to raise. You know, we as shareholders of Comair, and we have a lot of faith in Comair. I mentioned earlier the vision for Comair was phenomenal. You know, we were really distraught at seeing what was happening and where it was going, and actually discovering what was really underneath the covers.
Mm. And the questions that he was asking, when you say relating to governance, was there anything specific you can share with us?
Well, if we're going to talk about that, yes, it was really around the tenure of the directors, whether they could genuinely be seen as being independent directors when they'd been part of the organization for so long. And they'd both been in executive capacities, many of them, not all of them, and also in non-executive capacities. But can someone really remain independent after 40-odd years? So that was one of the issues. The second one was around the joint CEOs and what their mandates were, who was responsible for what, because that was very grey. It seemed that both of them were responsible for everything. You know, we work in leadership. We know that that's not a recipe for success. So it was, you know, those were key points.
And you still think that you haven't had any influence on what's going on at the moment?
Well, we probably have in terms of just raising the issues in a public forum. I don't know whether they would have been raised publicly or not. I know that in many companies that's not the case. They tend to keep the, those kind of issues quiet. But you know, I do know, though, that, that these were the issues were being expressed before. So I think we just surfaced them.
Barbara, what happens next? You've had the pre-arbitration meeting. Presumably, it's arbitration from here.
Well, it's arbitration from here. We've had quite a long journey to get to the point where we were ready to submit our claim to Comair. And we've done exactly what, if we had been working with a leadership team that was facing this kind of a crisis, or any crisis really, you know, just taking that step back and looking at what are the resources we need? What do we need to be doing? How can we ensure that we are in the best possible place to be able to come out of this intact and potentially, you know, able to continue where we left off or even progress the business? So we're a small company. We don't have huge resources, and Comair is very aware of that. But what we do have is networks. And so we've tapped into our networks and been able to really to be able to get the best advice and the best. We've consulted with literally the best in the country. And we know that we're standing on a very strong ground now. And yeah, we were, by the time we issued the claim, we were absolutely ready to take them on. And it's been interesting to see Comair's response since.
And what has that been?
Well, initially, I think another interesting point to note is the appointment of our arbitrator, who's actually Robert Nugent, retired Judge Robert Nugent. He chaired the SARS inquiry.
Wow.
So he's going to
that's heavy, right?
It is. He'll be arbitrating this. And we're really glad about that because he has a reputation for being very fair, straight, direct, and not taking any nonsense. And we've experienced, Comair did tell us a while back that if we were to go to arbitration, that they would try and drag things out, and the you know they were very open. Their attorneys are very open about telling us that this could take up to 2 years, and we've just run out of money. And so we've been very careful to make sure that that's not going to happen. And we've I think been able to structure ourselves quite incredibly well, actually. And this will later on I think become an example for other small businesses how to do it. You don't necessarily need to have the biggest pockets. You just need to know where to look for the support. So with that, we've been able to consult with people like Theo Boate. He helped us a lot with preparing for the AGM. We've had really good advice. Our advocate is Paul Farlam, Senior Counsel Paul Farlam. Paul's father is Ian Farlam, who chaired the Marikana Commission, the biggest damages claim ever paid out. In South Africa, the most successful damages claim. So we've consulted with the head of forensic accounting at WITS. We know that we're on a good footing. We know that we were not in breach, that there was actually an error in Comair's accounting. And so this is what we go into the arbitration with. Our facts are solid, and we're very confident in our case.
You know, on the one hand, you're seeing the board of directors at Comair that's being shaken up and long-standing members leaving. That surely would have an impact or an influence on the culture and the way it would address issues like yours. Have you seen any of this?
We haven't seen any of it, Alec. I would hope it will, and we certainly remain very open to talking to them. Whether they decide to or not is really going to be up to them. I don't know what the new board is going to decide about that. So we're very open to talking to them, and if they still maintain their stance that they will, you know, they're going the legal route, or we'll go to arbitration. What we are going to do is ensure that it doesn't drag out. And we're in it for the long term, however long it takes. But already we've seen attempts at them to drag it out that have been stopped. And so we're hoping that they'll actually just come on board now and deal with it.
Barbara Walsh is the founder or co-founder of Metaco. Well, it's a welcome to Chris Yelland, who is our go-to guy, anything to do with Eskom. And my goodness, it's been a week of drama at Eskom, Chris. Now, without getting into all the chaos that's happened there, just to start off with, the resignation of the chairman, Jabo Mabuza, was that expected from where you sit?
Well, he was coming under enormous pressure even before the commitment made and broken by the president apparently on the word of the chairman and Eskom. And so I think following that, the president must have been seriously and severely embarrassed. And I think Jabu Mabuza found his position untenable. And he also probably was thinking, you know, he really doesn't need this in his life at this stage of his life. And he resigned. It was really interesting to read between the lines of his letter. It was not quite an apology from what I could see. He basically said that he had explained the risks to the president. And I think he was perhaps a little surprised that the president then went on to make a promise in light of the fact that he had in fact explained the risks of load shedding going forward over this period. Even though the probability may be lower than normal, there are serious risks. And there certainly were serious risks, as reality showed.
Mm. And then the pressure on his boss, Pravin Gordhan, to resign as well. Do you think there's much in that?
Well, it seems to be building up very intensely, even within the upper echelons of the ANC. So I think the pressure is a reality. Whether or not the president will bow to that pressure remains to be seen. I must say it would be extremely disturbing if the if Minister Pravin Gordhan had to resign, or that Eskom should be removed from his control and put under the Department of Mineral and Energy and Resources under Gwedi Mtasha. The disruption to the Eskom would be very severe, I believe. Especially, you know, it's coming almost, you know, at the same time as the departure of the previous chairman, Mr. Mabuza, as well as the arrival of the new CEO. I think it would achieve absolutely nothing in my mind, and would have huge downside risk. So I don't see any upside benefit at all. I hope it doesn't happen, but never a dull day in politics.
Yeah, so it's all politics, all of that.
I believe it's very politically driven. There's a kind of a power struggle underway for the control of Eskom by forces, some forces who are opposed to Pravin Gordhan. Some people would say that's because he is cleaning up the act, and a lot of people are feeling under pressure. A lot of vested commercial interests in the coal and nuclear sector would be pushing against Pravin Gordhan and supporting Gwede Mentasha. It's really a very poisonous environment right now.
How did they get it wrong, though? Because if you considering the new administration is trying to position itself as the clean administration, cleaning up the corruption of the past, they don't really have much room to make mistakes like the mistake that was made, where there was a promise that load shedding wouldn't start until Monday the 13th. It seems like a manufactured crisis, because I think all of South Africa knows that load shedding is here and is going to continue for a while. And I doubt that too many people would have planned their lives on load shedding not beginning a few days early. But how could they get something like that wrong?
Look, you know, I don't really think, the issue really right now is to do with, governance or with things like maintenance. I think the situation has gone well beyond that. And we really are in a situation now where, look, there has been a measure of a cleanup, and I'm sure there's a lot more still to be done. And that's going to take time anyway, whoever is in control, whoever. But then we have this whole issue of maintenance. Now, I must say, I think the issues have moved beyond maintenance. It's beyond playing games of Tetris and shuffling generators, scheduling and rescheduling them for maintenance to try and maximize the maintenance. These are old plants. They are decrepit. They are damaged. They have been abused by overloading, by skipping and deferral of maintenance, and by skipping of their midlife refurbishment, which is a very deep level maintenance that is done and refurbishment done at midlife. These have been skipped. So this old plant that is beyond midlife is really in bad shape, and it's no longer about maintenance. There isn't enough space to do the maintenance anymore, because when they do, if they had to do the kind of maintenance that is needed, they will go into load shedding. And there's even talk that that might be the right strategy, to have a continuous period of load shedding. At least people can plan their lives and businesses around that. But the bottom line is, we need new generation capacity, and we need it fast. There's not only a capacity shortage, there's also an energy shortage. We need more energy. And the solutions really are to procure new least cost energy, which comes from wind and solar PV, backed up by new least cost generation capacity, flexible generation capacity, which comes in the form of gas to power plants and battery energy storage. And that's, if you look at the integrated resource plan for electricity, that's where all the new capacity is coming from, not from nuclear, not from new coal. And I believe that's quite right. That is the right thing, the pro what is in the IRP. The problem at the moment is we have a Minister of Energy who seems to be going back on his very own IRP and stalling the procurement of what is in the IRP for the next 10 years. And we're left in this really crisis mode, and something has to be done fast. And the shortest term options facing South Africa right now are to harness the energy of the private sector, the human energy and the natural energy, wind and solar and gas and battery energy storage that will come from the customers of electricity at no cost to government. And this can be delivered quickly within the next 6 months to 2 years if we can only unlock the blockages that are preventing government from opening up this market.
It sounds so rational, but there is, you mentioned the blockages. What's the argument for these blockages?
The arguments are, in my view, driven by political ideology and contestation for resources and vested interests that are vying to protect their territory. Just to give you an example, the coal mining industry has been one of the big success stories of black economic empowerment in South Africa. Many small, medium, and large emerging coal miners have gone into this field and indebted themselves in so doing. In other words, they've borrowed money, they've got into this industry, and they deeply committed. They saw this as the future, but they haven't realized that, in fact, what they were buying were the liabilities of the coal majors, who are all pulling out because they've got a little bit more vision. And they're leaving the emerging miners with these toxic assets. And now all of a sudden there's talk about an energy transition and moving away from coal. And you can imagine these people who've basically mortgaged their lives to buy these assets and to get involved in coal mining are going to hang on to these things for dear life, because their whole financial future depends on it, and they will be ruined if there was an energy transition, as there has to be. So these huge vested interests are at play. There are also nuclear vested interests at play, who really are still, unfortunately, still trying to make a nuclear comeback. And these forces are at play politically within organizations like NECSA, the Nuclear Energy Corporation, and within Eskom, and within the coal mining industry itself.
Now, you've written a very thoughtful piece that we are publishing on BizNews about all of this, about the way ahead. What do you think the chances are that the right people are going to be listening?
Well, I think people listen sometimes, but they don't hear. And it's to do with this political, ideological resistance to solutions that come as they have to come, because there are no other options, but they have to come from the private sector and from the market and from customers.
Yeah, I think, as I say, the political terrain and the ideology is highly contested at the moment. And looking at the history of the ruling party, I am not sure yet whether there is sufficient consensus in the political structures of the ANC. And here I'm talking really the cabinet level, the top six, the NEC, and the party itself and its alliance partners, COSATU and the South African Communist Party, who ideologically come from a different world view. And I'm not sure that there is sufficient prevailing consensus to move forward. And that is why we have seen this whole restructuring process of the electricity supply industry, which every knowledgeable energy sector analyst and knows has got to happen, but it is not happening. And I believe it's because there is not sufficient consensus within the power structures of South Africa to move forward on this with confidence.
Fascinating insights there from Chris Yelland, who is very close to what's been going on in that side. In fact, he's made a career out of understanding the whole electricity department. This special podcast is brought to you by Bright Light Solar, whose chief executive, Kevin Chambers, is with us. Kevin, when we've been having these conversations over the past few weeks, the reaction has been quite significant from the business community. Literally hundreds of people are interested in what's the option that you have to offer, and we'll get into that in a moment. But have you been getting back to these people? Have you been telling them exactly what it is that unpacking the incredible returns that are available through the whole J12 process?
Hi, Alec. Yes, we have been getting back to everybody that has expressed interest, and we are overwhelmed by the extent of the interest shown. So thank you to you and your community. The delay that we've had is the prospectus has not yet been finally approved for issue by the CIPC. We have had an indication today that this is likely to be on Wednesday this week. So hopefully on the 15th of January, the prospectus will now go live, and we will then send a copy of that prospectus or a link to it to everybody that has contacted us that has expressed interest. So at least we'll now be able to provide them with the legal document setting out details of our offering of shares.
Now, I've seen that prospectus. It's nearly 160 pages. It's a lot to read through. What should the prospective investors be looking for?
I think the most important parts of it is just an understanding of the business, but the one that I would recommend that people really focus on are the risk factors. Now, what we've tried to do is be as comprehensive as possible to set out all potential risks that an investor or that the company could face. And I think, as with any investment, you need to understand what can go wrong, and I think that's quite important. And then certainly anyone that has questions relating to anything, whether it be the risk factors or anything else contained in that prospectus, is then welcome to contact me, and I will happily meet with people and address any issues that they may have.
Why is a prospectus needed?
Because this is an offer to the public. So Bright Light Solar VCC is a public company, and in terms of the company, make an offer of shares to the public, you need a formal prospectus, which is, and the requirements of a prospectus are set out in the Companies Act. And as a result, this public offer is made in accordance with the regulations of the Companies Act.
And that, hence the CIPC, which presumably reads through it and makes sure that you guys aren't crooks.
Indeed. And they've actually been very thorough. They've asked some good questions. And they obviously were now closed for the Christmas period. They have just reopened. And we are hoping, as I say, to have this approved for publication on Wednesday.
Kevin, both of us have been in the financial markets for a long time. And I remember during the booms in the stock market, one would always have a look at who the advisors are, because that would give you a good insight into how credible the offer to the pub, or I suppose we could call it the pre-listing offer or the IPOs to public companies listed on the stock exchange, would give you a very good insight. So I'm going to ask you the same question. Who are your advisors? Who are the people that you have on your mastheads?
So we have been using Worksmans as our attorneys from the very beginning of setting up Brightlight. We've got a very strong relationship with them. And as you say, the amount of scrutiny that we get from our advisors is absolutely key. So Worksmans are our legal advisors, and Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer are our tax advisors. And equally, they have been incredibly thorough in delving into the tax issues related to Brightlight. And because it is a Section 12J company, it is really important that we have tax advisors, because it is a bit of a minefield. If you do something wrong, the implications for investors could potentially be quite significant.
So by having those big names, CDH and Worksmans, and by the way, who are your auditors?
It is BDO. So it was previously Grant Thornton, and Grant Thornton then were taken over by BDO South Africa.
All right. So having those big names on your prospectus, do they check it to make sure that everything you say is honest and correct and truthful? Is that why they're there?
So they're there to review everything that we say. So from a BDO point of view, they have reviewed all of our forecasts in great detail, and they have signed off on that. In terms of all the legal angles that are required, Worksmans have obviously ticked that box. And in fact, whilst we have prepared the prospectus, everything is reviewed in detail by Worksmans on that. And then, yes, in terms of all the tax issues, that's all then been approved by Cliff Decker. And CDH have also issued their own report, which forms part of the prospectus.
All right. So there's everything that one, as a potential investor, would possibly want to know from. How much money are you going to be raising through this prospectus?
So it is an open-ended potential capital raise. What we have stated in the prospectus is that we're looking to raise 100 million rand. If there is demand in excess of the 100 million rand, the directors have the ability to extend it. In February 2019, we raised just shy of 94 million rand. And, we don't really know what the potential demand is going to be. One of the factors that could curtail that potential demand are the new caps that came in that we discussed previously, where an individual or a trust is now limited in their tax deductibility to a maximum of 2.5 million rand per taxpayer per year, and companies are now limited to claim a maximum of 5 million rand. Now, we previously had investors that were significantly higher than that, so we just don't know how much we are going to raise.
Is there a minimum? In other words, if it's unsuccessful, is there a cap there, and
yes,
what would happen?
The minimum is 10 million rand.
And then what would happen then if you didn't raise 10 million rand?
Then the C offer, which is the offer that's the third offer that we're now raising, so the C tranche would then be cancelled, and any monies that had been submitted would then be returned back to investors.
All right. So the risk here is all to do with the financial returns. It's in the prospectus. Read the prospectus. It'll be available, you say, on Wednesday, on the 18th.
Subject to the CIPC giving us the approval, we should be live and good to go on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. And when will it close? When does the offer, the prospectus close?
So we are closing on the 25th of February. That gives us then 3 days to be able to send RT3B returns back to all investors, so that by the 28th of February, every investor has already received their RT3B, and that then allows them to claim the Section 12J allowance or deduction in their tax return, their e-filing submission, which they would be making on the 28th of February. So it is a very quick turnaround,
and the benefit that an investor will receive is almost immediate if they are a provisional taxpayer.
And just in a nutshell, explain how that benefit works.
So Section 12J says that an investor that invests into an approved Section 12J share scheme is allowed to deduct the full cost of that investment against their taxable income in the year in which they invest. So let's say you have an investor that earns, say, 5 million rand in taxable income. He chooses to invest, say, 1 million rand in a venture capital scheme, venture capital company, Section 12J company. They all used interchangeably. In his tax return, his e-filing, it asks the question, have you invested in a venture capital company? It then opens a drop-down box. You say, yes, I've invested 1 million rand. And then the e-filing calculator says gross taxable income 5 million rand. You've invested 1 million rand in a 12J investment, and therefore your taxable income is immediately reduced to 4 million rand. So you don't even land up paying the tax and then claiming it back. It's immediately deducted off the tax that you are paying on the 28th of February.
Kevin, surely this is quite a nice opportunity for companies who might have a provisional, and individuals who might have a provisional tax problem. Take, for instance, your company's done better, or your income has been better than what you thought it would have been at the halfway stage when you had to pay provisional tax. Am I on the wrong path here?
So it is certainly a tax planning opportunity. The one thing I would like to stress, however, is that there is a required minimum holding period of 5 years. So it's not a short-term tax planning opportunity. Investors need to think long-term. The money is going to be locked up for at least 60 months. If they redeem for any reason within that 60-month period, there is a full recoupment of their initial Section 12J allowance that they received. So, yes, it is absolutely a tax planning tool, but people need to think long-term.
And what are the returns? Just recap on those.
So the returns that we are offering our investors, and those returns are made up of three different factors. The first one is the upfront Section 12J allowance. The second one are dividend returns, and we pay dividends every 6 months from year one. And then we are expecting the majority of investors to exit in month 61, when that five-year period, that initial lockup, is then made, it then falls away. The effect of those returns on an investor in Brightlight is that they should receive an effective 21% after-tax return over that five-year period.
And where does the money get invested? I guess there's a clue, because you call Brightlight solar.
So we are investing in underlying companies. They are referred to as qualifying companies in the Income Tax Act, and those qualifying companies are the ones that then install fully paid solar installations into our target market is primarily the gated estate market, so homeowners associations and sectional title buildings, although we do commercial and industrial buildings as well. And what we then do is we pay for the full upfront capital cost of that installation, and we then sell the electricity that is generated to those customers over the period. They then pay for the electricity consumed on a monthly basis. We use that electricity revenue that we then receive to pay back to our investors in the form of dividends. And the electricity cost that we are selling, the price per kilowatt hour that we are selling to these customers, is normally at a reasonably substantial discount to what they are currently paying to their current utilities.
It sounds like the kind of scheme that you'd like to see really exploding in South Africa, given the issues that the country has with power. Are you being supported by the authorities?
So we are in an area called small-scale embedded generation. Apologies for the technical nature of that, but What that means is that it is typical rooftop type installation. There are very few regulations that are problematic to us because all of our installations from a residential point of view are small scale, as the name implies. And all we have to do with that is we then register with the local authority. I think that's quite an important factor, just to allow the local utilities to be able to manage their load and be aware of the size of the solar installations. But from a regulatory point of view, we don't encounter substantial regulatory impediments.
So you said right in the outset that you're looking to raise $100 million, but it's open-ended. So how big is the demand for the capital in this field?
So, Alec, the pipeline that we have at the moment, and when we refer to a pipeline, these are proposals that we have given to investors and to customers. And we, in November last year, crossed the 1 billion rand mark from a pipeline point of view. Now, I want to stress, not all of that billion rand is going to result in installations, but that pipeline is constantly growing, and we would certainly expect a reasonable portion of that billion rand to materialize into closed deals. So from a deal flow point of view, we are seeing the potential opportunity in multi-billions in the next few years, because there is just such an incredible need, as we all aware of, the you know, the kind of load shedding and electricity restrictions that we all exposed to. So the kinds of opportunities that we see in this market are, I won't say uncapped, but certainly very substantial.
Kevin James is the Chief Executive of Bright Light Solar, and this special report was brought to you by Bright Light Solar. And that ends the Rational Radio show for this week. We'll be back again, same time, same place next week. It's noon on a Monday. Join us then. Until then, from Alec Hogg, cheerio.